my soul. You know in hardship I changed my goals. Now I realize I was so unwise. Abandoned your advice.
Faced with your frown,
help was always near. If we persevered,
if we held up
just for a while.
Allah, Allah, ya Allah. Allah, Allah, ya Allah. Salli ala al-Mustafa, al-Hadi, al-Mujtaba, wal-Ali kiram. Allah, Allah, ya Allah. Allah, Allah, ya Allah. Salli ala al-Mustafa, al-Hadi, al-Mujtaba, wal-Ali kiram.
My life is empty without you. Nothing I've gained is without you. If you are pleased, my soul can breathe. Where would I be without you? My heart now flees these worldly dreams, yearning for mercy from you. Now I realize I was so unwise. Abandoned your advice.
Faced with your frown,
help was always near. If we persevered,
if we held up
just for a while.
Allah, Allah, ya Allah. Allah, Allah, ya Allah. Salli ala al-Mustafa, al-Hadi, al-Mujtaba, wal-Ali kiram. Allah, Allah, ya Allah. Allah, Allah, ya Allah. Salli ala al-Mustafa, al-Hadi, al-Mujtaba, wal-Ali kiram. Allah, Allah, ya Allah. Allah, Allah, ya Allah. Salli ala al-Mustafa, al-Hadi, al-Mujtaba, wal-Ali kiram. Allah, Allah, ya Allah. Allah, Allah, ya Allah. Salli ala al-Mustafa, al-Hadi, al-Mujtaba, wal-Ali kiram. Al-Hadi, al-Mujtaba, wal-Ali kiram. Al-Hadi, al-Mujtaba, wal-Ali kiram.
Heroes of the 8-year Holy Defense. The first of the Iranian month of Mehr that fell on September 22nd in 1980 was the day on which, without any provocation, Saddam of the repressive Ba'ath minority regime of Baghdad, on the orders of the U.S., launched a full-scale ground, sea, and aerial invasion of the Islamic Republic of Iran in a bid to seize the oil-rich border lands and to overthrow the dynamic system of government established by the sage of the age, Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon his soul. The elaborate plots of the invaders soon went awry when Iranian Muslims, on the instructions of the father of the Islamic Revolution, rallied to the war fronts to stage epics and blunt the full-fledged aggression, although the war dragged on for 8 years because of tens of billions of dollars poured into Saddam's coffers by his Arab reactionary backers and accomplices, mainly Saudi regime and the regime in Kuwait, as well as the military hardware provided to him by global arrogance led by the great Satan, the U.S. Please stay with us for the first part of a new daily series on the occasion titled Heroes of the Holy Defense. There are brilliant epics in the history of every nation in view of the resolve of the people to offer self-sacrifice for defending the honor of their country and religion. Without the least doubt, the Islamic Republic of Iran is one such nation which, infused by the grassroots movement of the people at a time when the world was divided between capitalist West and the communist East, gained victory with the slogan, "Neither East nor West, Islam is the best." The U.S. and its accomplices viewed the emergence of a strong, independent, and Islamic Iran as a danger to their vested interests in the region and hatched a wide variety of plots in a bid to overthrow the Islamic Republic system of government. They backed the anti-revolutionaries and terrorists of all hue and color by attempting to spread seditions and separatist currents in some border provinces, such as Kurdistan and Khuzestan. Their plots, however, failed thanks to Iran's committed youths that got together to form the Basij Mobilization Forces and the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps for the defense of the country and to safeguard the achievement of the Islamic Revolution at a time when the regular armed forces were being purged of officers influenced by the U.S. and the enemies of Islam and Iran. These popular forces, after defeating the seditious and separatist moves, fully displayed their commitment and religious national aspirations by enacting epics throughout the 1,200-kilometer-long border with Iraq to defeat the armed-to-the-teeth Ba'athist war machine. The memories of these immortal heroes who sacrificed their limbs and life are alive today. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has rightly hailed these heroes of Islam and Iran, since jihad is one of the basic tenets of Islam. The late ideologue of the Islamic Revolution, martyr Ayatollah Murtaza Mutahhari, had said in this regard, "Islam is not a religion that says if someone slapped your face on the right, offer the left to him for another slap. It considers defense of faith necessary, and, as is evident in the Holy Quran, in order to safeguard faith, one should either migrate from that land, or if he has the means, should organize jihad against the devilish forces." Thus, in view of these facts and as per the dynamics of Islam, Iranian youths not only rallied to the front for liberating the occupied parts of their homeland from the Ba'athists, but for defending their faith and revolution embarked on efforts in various fields to make the country self-sufficient. One of the leading defenders of the country on the battlefield was Dr. Mustafa Chamran. He undoubtedly remains one of the immortal heroes of the Holy Defense. Born into a religious family on March 8, 1932 in Tehran to Hassan Chamran Savoji, who was originally from Chamran village of Saveh, after completing his preliminary studies, he graduated from Tehran University's College of Technology in the field of electromechanics. After a year's teaching, he won scholarship for higher studies in the U.S., where he obtained his Ph.D. in electrical engineering and plasma physics in 1963 from the University of California, Berkeley. Parallel to his scientific and academic pursuits, Chamran was active in the political and social fields as a person who from his youth was a committed Muslim, having been one of the first members of Tehran University Students Islamic Society. In the U.S. also, he founded many revolutionary societies and organizations, such as the Iranian Students Society, the Iranian Students Islamic Society, and Islamic Society of Muslim Students. He worked for a while at one of the NASA-related research centers in the U.S. named Bell Laboratory, where he was active in the field of satellites, guided missiles, and three-dimensional. Because of his political activities against the despotic Pahlavi regime, his work in the U.S. was cut short, forcing him to go to Egypt, where he obtained guerrilla warfare training for 2 years. In 1965, he went to Lebanon and became a prominent assistant to Imam Musa Sadr. He helped found the movement of the deprived and then the Amal organization for fighting the Zionist entity. The third phase of Dr. Chamran's life started after the victory of the Islamic Revolution of Iran. He returned after 21 years of life abroad and put his scientific and revolutionary experiences in the service of the country. He strove to groom the first group of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. Then, as Deputy Prime Minister for Revolutionary Affairs, he bravely embarked on nullifying the anti-revolutionary plots. His unforgettable epic in organizing resistance in the city of Parver in Kurdistan is legendary. One of the missions entrusted to him by the father of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, was to free the army and popular forces from the siege of anti-revolutionaries in Parver. He admirably discharged his duties and liberated Parver. The Imam appointed him the Minister of Defense, and he spared no efforts for organizing the country's defense. Dr. Chamran was not seeking power, wealth, and fame. For this reason, on the outbreak of the Iraqi war, he went to the war fronts to set up irregular war headquarters in Ahwaz, the capital of Khuzestan province, for countering the Ba'athist army. Dr. Mustafa Chamran succeeded in preventing the advance of the Ba'athists, and in some regions he managed to drive them back. This well-known soldier of Islam was finally martyred in one of his missions on the battlefield and gained his cherished wish of martyrdom in the path of God. Imam Khomeini, in a message on the occasion of martyrdom of Dr. Chamran, said, "Chamran spent a lifetime from start to end with a grand divine purpose and a pure and untainted ideology without attachment to any political groups and bands. His life was dedicated to gaining the light of divine knowledge and earning proximity to God, and he strove on that path and sacrificed his life for it. He lived and died in honor. May his soul be joyous and may he be always remembered."
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You are listening to the program The Key on Iran Radio with Sheikh Shiraz, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program The Key here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we're going to be examining a very important question, and that question is related to a theme that has recurringly been mentioned in many places in the Holy Quran, as well as the Hadith. Of course, I am speaking of the remembrance of God Almighty. In one verse of the Holy Quran, we read the following. O you who have faith, do not let your possessions and your children distract you from the remembrance of God. And whoever does that, it is they who are the losers. In this beautiful verse of the Holy Quran, God Almighty, he emphasizes the importance of his remembrance and remembering him. And he equates the forgetfulness of God with loss, and consequently the remembrance of God as success and felicity. Also, in one prophetic hadith, the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam has been reported as having said this: never prefer anything above the remembrance of God, for verily, he says, and the remembrance of God is surely greater. In this hadith of the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, the Prophet said that the remembrance of God is superior to every other thing in this world, and therefore it should not be nothing else above should be chosen above it and instead of it. Now, the question we want to pose today with respect to this theme and this topic is, why is the remembrance of God so great? Or, in other words, what are the outcomes and results of the remembrance of God? In order to answer this question, we can take inspiration from the hadiths which have been mentioned and passed down to us regarding this topic. In one beautiful hadith, it's been narrated that Imam Ali alayhi salam says, continuous remembrance of God enlightens the heart and the mind. Of course, this is a hadith about the continuance and perpetuity of the remembrance of God, you know, constantly remembering God. But nevertheless, it does allude to one of its benefits, and that is that when we remember God much, it illuminates our mind, it gives clarity to our mind, we begin to think properly, we begin to examine situations and circumstances better. You know, it leads to the clarity of the intellect. It leads to the clarity of the intellect. This is one of the results of the remembrance of God. In another beautiful hadith, Imam Ali alayhi salam said, and this is, he mentioned this in a supplication, in a dua that he made. O he whose name is a remedy and whose remembrance is a healing. In this dua, in this prayer, Imam Ali alludes to the fact that remembrance of God, it heals the heart, and it is a remedy for all ailments. In one beautiful hadith, Imam Ali alayhi salam said, the remembrance of God is a repellent of Satan, meaning it hinders the approach of Satan. It does not allow him to tempt us, to misguide us, and to lead us astray. So it serves as a shield against the temptations of Satan. This kind of echoes a theme mentioned in the Holy Quran. In one verse of the Holy Quran, God says that when those who believe are tempted by Satan, they remember God, and they are given clarity, and they realize what's going on, and they repel Satan in this way. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the results and the fruits of the remembrance of God in the light of the hadith of the infallibles, alayhim assalam. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You just listened to the program The Key on Iran Radio with Sheikh Shiraz, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
activists who do not just challenge systems, they confront them head on. They blur the lines between protest and provocation, pushing public discourse into uncomfortable but necessary territory. Their work is often polarizing, but it's rooted in a deep conviction to dismantle injustice. My guest today is one such activist. Welcome to SORP. I am Bahman Uroy.
Calla Walsh is an American political activist, writer and organizer known for her outspoken views on US foreign policy, anti-imperialism and Palestinian solidarity. She is a member of the Democratic Socialists of America and co-chair of the National Network on Cuba. Walsh has contributed to different media outlets and has participated in delegations to Cuba and Syria. In 2023, she was arrested during direct actions targeting Elbit Systems, an Israeli military contractor, as part of a work with Palestine Action US.
Calla Walsh, it's a pleasure to have you on SORP.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. I know you must be very tired, but let me just get to the first question. We'll take it from there. What first sparked your interest in activism and political organizing?
I think the first issue that really sparked my interest was the climate crisis, and I quickly realized that we cannot stop the climate crisis without stopping imperialism, and that imperialism is the greatest destroyer of the environment in the world. And I think at first, as a kid in the United States, we aren't taught to care about any country except ourselves. But as my process of getting involved politically developed, I realized the necessity of fighting against US-led imperialism.
Right. And were there formative experiences growing up that shaped your worldview?
Well, I was 12 years old when Donald Trump was elected, and certainly I don't think Donald Trump is an aberration in the long, long history of fascist, genocidal, racist U.S. presidents, but there was a huge spark of political activity and protest and momentum in that moment, and I got involved at a very young age in different movements, whether it was the Women's March, the March for Our Lives against gun violence, and later the 2020 protests against police violence and racism and brutality. And I was involved in many different ways of protesting, of organizing. And as I know we're going to talk about, one of those very formative experiences was working on campaigns and really trying to work within the system like we are told to, and trying to use all these legal means to make change, and realizing over time that politicians don't work for the people. They work for weapons companies and oil companies, and that we need to use other tactics and strategies to make change.
Right. I'm just curious. You were 12-year-old lady when Donald Trump came into office for the very, very first time. So that's such a young age. How would such a young girl get interested even in the politics of these things? You know, what familial background helped you shape that sort of worldview?
Well, I grew up in the United States, but my family is Irish-American. Uh-huh. I've never been to Ireland. My family and my extended family, we aren't very connected to our Irish heritage or background. But once I started to learn about settler colonialism in the U.S. and how this entire American identity, just like the Israeli settler Zionist identity, is a genocidal construct that is built upon the blood of the indigenous peoples of North America, just like the Zionist entity is built upon the blood of the Palestinian people.
Right.
And so connecting to where I'm truly from, where my family is truly from, and learning the fierce, militant history of resistance in Ireland to colonialism, to imperialism, and solidarity with the Palestinian cause, I think gave me a much, much deeper understanding of what struggle means.
Of course.
That it's something that my people have been partaking in for 800 years against colonialism.
So this must have also been kind of a trigger for you to go and study the heritage and the background and what happened with the Irish cause.
That's
very interesting, of course. How did your early involvement in climate justice evolve into broader anti-imperialist work?
Like I said, I was part of a lot of climate organizing, of youth groups such as the Youth Climate Strike, and most of our actions were focused on asking politicians to change their policy. I participated in protests outside the White House, in the halls of Congress, begging our elected officials to listen to us to protect our future. And what I realized is that, asking politely the people in power to, make change that actually works against their own interests when these politicians' campaigns are funded by, all these corporations. And even many of the politicians who claim to be pro green energy, pro sustainability, such as Ed Markey, who I believe we're going to discuss in a bit. Many of them, talk this talk, but in reality, they support the U.S. military, which is the greatest polluter on planet Earth and has caused more environmental destruction and pollution than any other entity on planet Earth. And so, what I realized is that. Imperialism is the primary contradiction in the world today, and that is what we need to focus our struggle on because it encompasses every single issue. We can't have climate justice, we can't have women's rights, we can't have fair housing and any of the things we want to see while we live in a system of global exploitation and constant war and genocide, which is what the U.S. and Zionist and NATO empire feed off of.
Right. Now I'm going to talk about a little bit about the digital organizing and the youth movements that you were part of. What was it like helping build the Markeyverse and mobilizing Gen Z voters? Tell me about that.
First, let me just say it's crazy to hear that term said on Iranian TV, but that was... A big effort.
I did my homework.
It was a big effort that I was involved in. I guess flash forward a couple years after I got involved politically, the COVID pandemic hit. I was 15. I was a sophomore in high school, and suddenly I was stuck at home and locked inside. And so all of the organizing that I was doing shifted to the digital sphere, and a lot of adults and folks, working in political organizations and campaigns didn't know how to use the tools of social media to mobilize young people in the way that young people who are just fluent in these platforms do. And we innovated really creative techniques to turn out young voters. And we really emphasized, the candidate that we were supporting, Ed Markey, his stance on the Green New Deal, on progressive legislation that we supported. But in retrospect, a lot of that legislation, it was simply to improve the lives of people living in the U.S. And that is predicated upon the continuation of the, exploitation of the Global South, the continuation of these wars and these genocides. And I still learned a lot from those experiences. I've arrived at the politics I have today by trying all these different tactics and strategies and realizing, what is futile versus what actually poses a threat to the ruling class and to our oppressors.
Right. And how do you see digital activism changing the landscape of political engagement?
To borrow a phrase from Fidel Castro, I think the battle of ideas is being waged on social media. And so we cannot write off the digital sphere. We cannot write off these platforms as important battlegrounds for us to wage ideological struggle, to counter imperialist propaganda. If we look at how, the CIA and various imperialist agencies' investments and strategies and budgets have shifted over the past decades, increasingly so much is being invested on propagandizing through the digital sphere. You know, I think some really good examples are the regime change attempts in Cuba and in Iran, which attempt to portray themselves as, you know, organic, homegrown protest movements, but in reality are usually hashtags that were created in Washington, D.C. or Langley, Virginia. And that's why I'm so honored to be here, because what I do have is a platform where I can, you know, share the reality that I'm seeing. And while I don't claim to be an expert on anything, really, I do think that, you know, having young people from the United States see this reality and see, you know, the destruction of that is caused by the U.S. Zionist aggression, and to bring back those lessons to people in the U.S. To understand is absolutely essential.
Well, you know, Carla, we are living in a world with mainstream media having the final say in many, many of the events that we are surrounded by. How do you make yourself heard by the people around you while they are also all being bombarded by these mainstream media regarding the truth that you have uncovered?
I think that's another, you know, change that's been caused by the shift to digital platforms and social media is, although mainstream media is dominant in many ways, social media kind of democratizes how we receive news. And so regular people, yes, despite, you know, not working for the BBC or CNN or MSNBC, we can create a platform for ourselves. And I think often that is so much more compelling to our audience and to people who want to understand what is happening in the world, because frankly, mainstream media is very dishonest, and I think the average person is smart enough to realize that and to be disillusioned with it. And the fact is, they ignore, you know, the vast majority of what is actually happening in the world. And so, to create our own platforms and to elevate our own voices. And to speak the truth and without fear of being critical of power and of capital and of the imperialist ruling class is a great task, but I think it is one that we are seeing great progress on, and that consciousness is greatly shifting, yeah, especially among young people. And that is why the U.S. is trying to crack down on platforms like TikTok. That is why there is so much increasing censorship on platforms like Meta. I, of course, have been suspended many times on these platforms. But nevertheless, we have to continue to get our word out there. And we also need to be creative with how we disseminate ideas, because, yeah, increasingly, the censorship is only going to get worse, and we can't only be reliant on, you know, platforms that are controlled by our enemy.
Tell me something. I think within the American scene and the issue of censorship, I think it's getting harder and harder to get a message across. Do you think it's always been like that, or it has become visibly worse? Which one do you think it is?
I think it's both. You know, I think freedom of speech has always been a lie. It's freedom of speech for those who the government feels
almost
like it.
Almost everywhere.
Yes, but I do think we've seen some qualitative escalations and crackdowns in both the U.S. and in the so-called United Kingdom and in Europe. Yeah. I would point to, you know, the prescription of Palestine action in the U.K. Right. as a really extreme example. And, you know, our comrades there, they can't even say the words Palestine action without potentially being charged with terrorism. And in the United States, you know, it's not quite there yet, but we are seeing so many people being fired from their workplaces, being kicked out of their universities for mere anti-Zionist speech. You know, the sacrifice of losing a job or losing a degree is minuscule compared to what Palestinians are sacrificing, compared to what Iranians are sacrificing, compared to what, you know, the people in the entire global South, and especially the Axis of Resistance countries, are experiencing under U.S. Zionist imperialism. And so, in my view, the best way to respond to the censorship is to double down and to be louder than ever, because the louder that we are, the harder it is for them to silence us. And they actually can't possibly, you know, repress us all if we are all speaking out in support of the Palestinian resistance. And so while I expect for there to be more, for there to be more lawfare, for there to be more attempts to crush free speech, nevertheless, I think we have to, you know, double down on our pro-resistance speech. And, you know, I wanna shout out especially the organization Samizdat, which was designated in Canada and the U.S., and there were restrictions placed on it because they support the Palestinian resistance and because they fight for the freedom of Palestinian prisoners. And there was a lot of fear that was instilled in people in the movement that if they even say, you know, I stand by Sami Noon because of this, during this, you know, phony designation, there's a lot of fear that that could, you know, even lead to people being targeted. But if we all stand together and if we all, you know, stand in solidarity with people facing repression, it is impossible for them to be isolated. So, yes, I think it's important to use these moments of the intensified repression to build more unity in our principles of resistance and steadfastness.
Right. And after working on, well, of course, you worked on Senator Markey's campaign. What led you to your disenchantment with electoral politics?
I'd certainly been, you know, slowly getting disenchanted over time. I think my values and my principles were always far more radical than what could be expressed in an electoral campaign. But those were the opportunities that I found to get involved in change. And I realized, especially after taking part in protests in 2020, and then especially after what happened in Palestine in May 2021, the evictions in Sheikh Jarrah, the Six-Day War, and the bombardment of Gaza, that woke me up to the reality of imperialism and of the Zionist genocide against Palestine. And what I can only understand is my own complicity in that up until the moment that I broke with the U.S. states and working within the Democratic Party. Because the Democratic Party is, you know, just as genocidal and imperialist as the Republican Party. They just have different tactics and strategies through which they hold on to power. And like I said, I, you know, had worked for the senator, I'd worked for many politicians, and just seeing, you know, how horrific the bombardment was and also how heroic the Palestinian response, the response of the resistance in Gaza was, firing back at the Zionist entity, I realized it was a moment where I had to make a choice that would define the trajectory for the rest of my life, which was to split with this liberal, reformist, social imperialist part of the, you know, movement that I was in, and to self-criticize, to use that as an opportunity to bring more people over to being pro-Palestine, to being anti-Zionist. We started a pressure campaign on the senator to try to get him to change his stance. And the failure of that to get him to change his stance also made me realize that even though that was someone I'd worked for and invested my labor in and helped him win the election, that my voice made no difference compared to checks from AIPAC or checks from Zionist donors or from weapons companies or his investment in U.S. interests. And so after that, I became much more involved in the pro-Palestine movement, and I basically completely left electoral politics, and from there on out spoke very vocally about how I feel like electoralism is ultimately, you know, counterinsurgent, and that we need to make a firm, clean break and to work outside of these institutions to, you know, create something new, to build an alternative to empire.
Right. And of course, you were involved with politics for a while. Did you find different voices? Like, for example, what we hear from Senator Bernie Sanders. Did you see that sort of voices often within the politics, within the mechanics and the machination of the mechanics of politics in the U.S.? Such voices, are they just rare, Well, there are still more than just one person in there thinking the way he does.
I think that I see, you know, I see Bernie Sanders, I see Ed Markey, I see AOC and the Squad. Even, you know, Zohran Mamdani, who just won this election in New York. I still see this progressive, or someone call like Democratic Socialist wing of the Democratic Party. I see it as a concerted effort to try to bring young people back into the Democratic Party because they have lost so much support because of Palestine. Because young people saw the Democratic Party carry out a Holocaust for 2 years, live streamed before our own eyes. No wonder people aren't coming out and weren't voting for Kamala Harris. And I think the Democrats realize that, and they realize they need younger, more progressive people who will say Free Palestine as a slogan to try to get people back into voting them and working in the party. But these people are not anti-Zionist. They're not anti-imperialist. They constantly defend Israel's right to exist. They constantly condemn the Palestinian resistance and the entire axis of resistance. They constantly promote, you know, regime change and sanctions against Iran. And so I think while it's positive to heighten the contradictions within within Congress, within the Democratic Party, within the U.S. government, electing these politicians is not a means to an end, and we have to be very, very careful with, you know, how working within these institutions might force us to compromise our principles. And so that's why I'm very openly critical of them.
Right, I see. And do you believe progressive candidates can still drive meaningful change within the system?
I think at the local level, that argument could be made. But I think, as I just argued, you know, I think fundamentally,
I kind of got my answer.
Yeah, it's, I see it as, you know, a part of like the counterinsurgency. And I think when we have these huge ruptures and shifts of consciousness, like after the Al-Aqsa flood, there was a huge burst of, you know, anti-imperialist consciousness in the United States. And I think one of the responses by the Zionists, by the imperialists, by the ruling class, is to try to capture that energy and to funnel it into something that is fundamentally not challenging or threatening to U.S. empire. And so they would much rather have us be working on a campaign than, say, doing direct action against a weapons company.
Carla Walsh, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Course, and thank you for being with us on another soap. Thank you so much, and goodbye until next time.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step brothers not the last one
هو الذی ارسل رسوله بالهدى
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
وَالَّذِي أَرْسَلَ رَسُولَهُ بِالْهُدَى وَدِينِ الْحَقِّ لِيُظْهِرَهُ عَلَى الدِّينِ كُلِّهِ وَلَوْ كَرِهَ الْمُشْرِكُونَ
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم نیست.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
ولا تتفرقوا فيه.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran.
کتاب الله.
Good afternoon to all of our listeners. This is Iran Radio. Greetings from Tehran. Here are some interesting facts about Islam. Muslim scholar Ibn al-Haytham, known as Al-Hazen in Europe, who was born in 965 AD, formulated the scientific method and has been referred to as the world's first true scientist. He is also often regarded as the first theoretical physicist, making a significant contribution to the theory of light and optics. Additionally, he developed what is called celestial mechanics, which led to the eventual work of Europeans such as Copernicus, Galileo, Johannes Kepler, and Isaac Newton. We'll listen to the continuation of Iran Radio. Thank you for joining us. We'll start off this hour's programs with Youth Station, a program all about young people and dealing with topics related to youth. Next is Israel Watch. The program critically analyzes Zionist media reports about the current events and issues in the West Asia region. That will be followed by Back to Reality. In this roundtable discussion, young Muslims are invited to discuss some pertinent religious and social issues of today's Islamic world. Our varied radio productions feature will be next.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station. I am a Muslim.
Islam my deen.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحیم. السلام علیکم dear listeners of IRB English Radio. Welcome back to a very new episode of Youth Station. Well, this is me, Asma. Once more, I have the honor to be at your service. I have with me
Brother Ali at your service, like always.
Yes, thank you for being here. How much freedom do you think you have in your everyday life?
None.
So, freedom have got many definitions. Throughout history, if you look back in the accounts of great people, great scholars who defined freedom, I guess nobody points out on the fact that everyone can do whatever they wish to do.
Mm-hmm.
But us, I mean me, as an ordinary person,
mm-hmm.
I would believe at the first glance that freedom means I would have to do whatever my heart contents to do.
Yeah, that would be great, right?
Yeah, that would be so great.
That would be so great. But, I mean, let's face it. I mean, as you said, so many philosophers in the history, like from 2,000-3,000 years ago till now.
They're all engaged with the concept of freedom.
Concept of freedom, exactly. And one way or another, they face the reality that we don't have that, you know, unlimited version of freedom because we are living in a material world. And in a material world, you see the limited.
Too much freedom means anarchy.
Definitely.
Yeah, and nobody wants anarchy.
If you want to impose your freedom like upon everything, other people will do the same.
Yeah.
So.
And then, you know, because it would turn into a brutal world, then they would impose their freedom on you as well.
But kids, they don't know that, right?
Kids,
they're really free.
I guess they are not totally free. I do believe that they aren't as free as we think. Like, we have been a kid as well. So we don't do whatever we wish to do.
No, we didn't do that, but we didn't know the boundaries yet. We did not, you know, grow at a certain, you know, let's say phase to know there are so many bad things, there are so many limitations to this world.
Mm-hmm.
We just enjoy our life because we felt that we are free.
Yeah.
We can go wherever they want. We can do whatever they want, unless our parents do the other ways.
Yeah, come in the way and act as an impediment to what we do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So parents and ideology. So let's just go back to when we were children.
Yes.
As you claim that in the, you know, that psychologically speaking, when it's all about the id,
mm-hmm.
that part of you that is still does not know anything about morality, anything about the rules of society or
social norms.
Like exactly. Ideology. You know nothing about it. At that point, you seem, at least, to be so free without any boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
But then, as you start the realm of language, as you start to acquire a language, then that's the point where you start to gather rules.
That is the beginning of, like, the sad side of your life.
Yeah, entanglement. Thank you for being so hopeful.
Yes.
I'm so grateful that no child is listening to us.
But I want to be a child again, so maybe... That's my plan.
You can be. You're a child. You have a child inside of you right now as well.
Yes.
It's all is up to you. It's just to let it go.
Mm-hmm.
Just unleash it. Anyway.
I want to go find a supermarket and eat whatever I want.
So we were saying that at a specific age, I guess it would start at the age of 2.
Mm-hmm.
And above that, you would start to learn about ideology. Little by little, they would impose laws on you.
Yes.
Like, see, this is your friend. This is your sister. This is your sibling. You don't have to do this. You don't have to do that. So
yes.
Gradually, you're going to learn that there is no freedom.
There's no freedom. And you see, it's interesting that people who have, who have grown up in a sort of deserted areas, like, I'm not going to mention Tarzan or people like that, but like
yeah.
some villagers, like countrymen, they feel more free compared to us somehow because they have not been bombarded by so many norms. Sometimes mm-hmm. we think too much of those limitations.
Psychologically speaking,
okay.
that would be called the masks your super ego mm-hmm. would ask you to put on.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's because they don't have too much of boundaries.
Yes.
Like, for example, if you consider yourself, and I consider myself, as for me, I have a face when I come to my workplace.
Yeah.
I have another mask on my face when I'm with my family. I have another when I'm with my friends. And I have another when I'm at university.
Games
so technically,
masks.
A lot of masks. Do you deny that? Don't you have that?
Games of masks, as you said.
Yeah. See, everybody, I guess we all have it based on the context. And I think that's logical. There are some other people involved in my life as well.
Yeah.
So I don't want to be a source of oppression to other people. That's why I can't have an ultimate and absolute freedom.
But sometimes it's good to just go out
mm-hmm.
and just be like an, I don't want to say like an animal, be like a free man. Just, I
yeah.
don't know, prepare your own food from the nature. Just, I don't know, take your water from a river or something. Just feel like our ancestors.
But that's like getting back to our primitive stage. It's not picking up all those masks away.
Yes.
So it's getting back to our nature.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Right. So, welcome back. This is Youth Station. We were talking about what I would bring with myself into the nature, and brother was convincing me that, okay, you shouldn't take your PC, but I told him that I need internet and also my PC because I want to watch movies and TV series and stuff like that. And then you were just so strongly trying to convince me that I don't have to take them with me. Well, they are a part of the modern world, but I think in my own secluded, isolated version of world, I would let that trace of modernism into my life. It's okay.
It's okay.
Yeah, it's still okay.
But first of all, we didn't take that picnic as, I don't know, a picnic for good. We just, it was for a short amount of time, maybe 1 month or something.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm talking about for the rest of my life.
In that case, yeah, I would bring so many other things. Yeah, definitely.
See?
Sure. But what's the difference between that island and the same
city
you're living?
There's no people.
There's no people?
Yeah, there's no people.
Who cooks for you?
I would do that for myself. I would do everything for myself.
You should hunt first.
I won't hunt. I prefer to eat vegetables.
Vegetables? Okay.
Yeah.
Now you turn a vegan.
I can thrive on that. It's okay.
Yeah?
Okay.
That's an idea.
So, see, this is freedom.
Freedom.
If anyone wants to depict and picture their utopian world,